The Evolve with Pete Evans podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informal look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. I love exploring the topics that are not traditionally taught at school and take a deep dive into them with my special guests. I invite you to sit back and come along for the ride with an open mind and heart, and please share with your family and friends, as these podcasts may just be the seed from which many things will flourish from. Cheers. We've been using Waters Co. water filters for the last 10 years, and I wholeheartedly trust my family's health with them. Waters Co., established 1977, have personal and domestic water filters, which turns your ordinary tap water into great-tasting, alkaline, ionized mineral water, which removes up to 99.9% of fluoride, heavy metals, chemicals, and bacteria, so you can love your tap water again. The Bio 1000 is the latest edition of the BMP 1000 model and the culmination of over 40 years of experience and research into water filtration by some of the world's leading scientists. Waters Co. was first to market with natural gravity-fed systems, creating alkaline water way back in 1984, and have continued to lead the market in research and development, setting the benchmark for all other brands to follow. Please go to my webpage, PeteEvans.com, to learn more and to receive your special discount from my link on the products page. You're going to love it.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us. How are you, brother?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. You mentioned something just before we started recording, and you said COVID has been really good for podcasts, and it's more like science fiction instead of science these days. And I want you to elaborate on that and give us your perception of what's going on in the world at the moment.
Well, I prepare for this. I was just working out in my exercise room, and I was listening to the rap by RC Rapper, and it's called Just Say No. And he says, "Doc, I don't know. What you're saying doesn't make sense. It was just a touch of the flu. I think I'm going to be okay. I got to shut down my business for a whole year and wait for the shot." And he goes on and on. And this is a tremendous expression of young people and their interpretation of what's going on. It's almost like a science fiction movie, but it's playing out for real.
It's interesting you say that, because I had a conversation with a friend of mine who has a daughter that's a musician and starting her burgeoning career. And he was complaining about that right at the start of her career, COVID hit, so she can't travel and see the world and do this. And I said, and this was about 3 or 4 or 5 months ago. And I said to him, I'm really surprised there aren't more artists embracing this and actually creating content and art about what is actually happening right now. And just as you said, we're just starting to see a few people come out and actually feel comfortable or compelled to express their art, whether it be through music or writing a book or creating a documentary or whatever it may be. That freedom of expression, it seems like it's nearly been bottled up for the last 18 months and it's just about to explode.
But why was it bottled up, though? We've been through other crises. When I was a kid, we were in the middle of the Vietnam War. We didn't wait a year and a half to start protesting the Vietnam War. I mean, this is very different. What accounts for a year of no expression, a year of almost no discussion, a year of people being fearful. I get emails and phone calls every day from parents who are terrified of what's going to happen with their students at school. And I'll ask them, "Have you called the school office? Have you filed a letter? Have you let anybody know your viewpoint?" No.
So why do you think this is? Because it is probably the most bizarre part of this science fiction movie that we're acting out at the moment, is that suppression of expression, so to speak, or fear, individual fear of speaking out. I mean, I have been one of many in this country, in Australia, and anybody that is listening to this would understand what the mainstream media and other agencies have done to quell my my creative expression or freedom of speech and my ability to question the current narrative, the science fiction narrative, as I saw Donald Trump call it yesterday or the day before when he called out Dr. Fauci and said, Dr. Fauci doesn't talk about science, he talks about science fiction or something to that degree. And it's this fear. And I noticed this over the last year on social media, so many people had, it was nearly like they relied upon me to be their spokesperson. And I'm not saying this in an egotistical way, because what they would say is, I am so fearful of being able to say what you say because of what my family and friends will think of me.
So it's almost as if a blanket of submissiveness has come down on the earth. And for the first time, people who were independently expressing themselves and making sharp points regarding their feelings on certain topics, one or another, suddenly there's a blanket of submissiveness. And I get the same thing. I get compliments. Thank you so much for your courage. And I think about this. I'm just a doctor. All I've done is what I've always done my entire career. People get an illness. I treat it. I get them better. I take care of the next one. Somebody calls. I try to help them out. I'm doing nothing that I haven't done my entire career. And suddenly I'm courageous.
I was driving back from Sydney up to my farm yesterday, and it's a good 9-hour drive, so I enjoy that. I do it every week or two. My kids live in Sydney and gives me a great opportunity to spend 9 hours by myself listening and to whatever I need to, I choose to listen to. And one of the things that I had the great fortune of listening and watching was your speech to in Texas, I believe, to the Senate. And I might have these words wrong. But what I was overwhelmed with emotion was your very balanced and calm nature to express common sense, the way that you see it. I mean, it's your opinion based in your factual evidence. And a friend of mine had sent me an interview with you about a month ago, which is why I reached out to you. And he said, this is one of the most remarkable men that can get a point across in such a simple, non-threatening, but penetrative way, straight to the heart and straight to the soul. And I would love for you to be able to take us through the journey over the last 18 months of you becoming this spokesperson for common sense and doing it in a way, because what I want to understand is your intention behind, because you could, many people can get, I see a lot of anger out there in the world, and I don't think that is the right path for many, whereas yours is a very deliberate, I don't want to say subtle, but gentle approach, but it's more powerful than I think is anger. So take me through how you express yourself and why you express yourself this way.
Pete, I may have just been in the world, the right person at the right time with the right clarity and the right background and sufficient authority to be able to be the person at this time. It may have just been a convergent of, I'm 58 years old, an internist, a cardiologist, I'm a trained epidemiologist, I have a degree in epidemiology from University of Michigan. I've been studying chronic disease my entire career, heart and kidney disease, but I see patients every day in my practice. And I may have been just the right person at the right time to fall into a realm where I realized that this virus, which was spreading across the globe, could be treated and should be treated like any other virus or illness, that doctors should not be afraid of it, and that if one contracts the virus, which I did, that one can survive it and can get through it. And fortunately for most, it's no more than the common cold, although it is a potentially fatal illness. And I think that's what creates so much fear there. But I took an incredibly strong position early with my patients, with my family members. I lost a family member to this illness. And I took an approach that this illness was not going to sweep across the United States and slaughter people indiscriminately while every single doctor and every single patient and every single public official headed for the hills. I wasn't going to do it. I wasn't going to let it happen. It was mano e viro. It was me versus the virus. And I was going to step out and do that. And I found friends. They were courageous doctors already taking these steps. Probably the most celebrated is Dr. Vladimir Zelenko, Zev Zelenko, who is, I think, a total of 4'9" in height. He's got a beard down to his chest, an Orthodox Jew in New York City, who stepped out of the box and said, you know what, I'm going to treat this virus. I can figure it out. It can't be that hard. And we started communicating with one another. Our Italian friends were working on this. And we realized this virus was really unique. It looked like the common cold. It gave us about 2 weeks to figure out what was going on. And then it led to a abnormal immune system regulation, which was different than any of the things we had seen previously with asthma or other viruses or HIV. And then the very unique thing about this virus, it caused internal blood clotting. In fact, that's how people died of internal blood clotting. And we heard reports where patients would go into kidney failure and the dialysis tubes would clog up with blood clots in the lines. And then we saw CT scan patterns where the patterns looked like there was like tennis balls in the lungs in a sequence that was unlike any pneumonia. And then one of the big breakthroughs is the Italians had the courage to do an autopsy. Everyone was so fearful of this virus, we could not open up the human body and figure out what happened in the case of someone who succumbed to the infection. And when they did, and they sliced open the lungs, they found a unique form of blood clotting in the lungs, accounting for those balls that we saw on the CT scan. And the name of that clotting is called microaggregation. And it was a unique form where the red blood cells are sticking together without a lot of other blood clotting elements, which was very interesting. So we started to see a pattern that was unlike any other illness: viral replication, what we call cytokine storm, and thrombosis, microaggregation of red blood cells. We saw a depressed lymphocyte count, which we should be elevated. And then we saw an elevated D-dimer level, which was again pointing towards blood clotting. That became the theme of COVID-19 illness, the virus is SARS-CoV-2. And as I fast forward, unusual things started happening. And I've told the story many times. Everything started to get derailed. We had our peer-reviewed publication system become compromised. And the usual processes for peer review and editorial review and publication became corrupt. And we saw a cessation of research. We saw something very amazing in the United States. We have 5,600 hospitals, 2,200 acute care hospitals. We have between 300 and 400 top-line medical schools. We have iconic medical institutions in the United States: Harvard, Yale, Johns Hopkins, Mayo Clinic. These are brand name blue ribbon institutions. These institutions, not in a single case, attempted to help a patient with COVID-19 prevent hospitalization and death. And as COVID-19 was spreading across the United States, the people looked at this, the public looked at this and said, there's only one of two, there's two things that I want to avoid. I want to avoid the hospital. I want to get put in isolation and never see my family members again. And I don't want to die. And if we could avoid those two, Pete, then if we could just get through the illness at home, that would be a victory. Everyone would consider that a victory. So hospitalization and death, in my view, was the binary composite endpoint that our entire effort should have been focused on to prevent hospitalization and death. And yet the focus became everything else but hospitalization and death pretty quickly.
Why?
I wish I had the answer. I wish I had the answer. I think part of it was fear. And I was on these conference calls originally, these task force calls, and it was all about personal protective equipment and how do we keep the hospital sanitary? We shut down our clinics. We shut down our operating rooms. I remember March and April, I looked out of my office. There was an empty parking lot. You know, we saw hospital volumes come way down. All the usual medical complex really shut down, and we were waiting for the tsunami of patients, and it didn't come. And we waited. And I remember the Army National Guard came into Dallas, Texas, and went to the K. Bailey Hutchison Convention Center and set up a field hospital. They set up all these beds. They had the IV lines. They had the ventilators. And we were like, oh my gosh, this virus is going to slaughter us down here in Texas. And I started looking at the patterns like an epidemiologist. And I remember those reports. Mario Cuomo was in New York City, and he was barking out orders. And President Trump had this big naval ship come up the harbor in New York. And Mario Cuomo came out and said, this virus is going to spread across the country like a tidal wave. Dallas, Texas, you just wait. Your time is coming. You know, we went into an absolute state of fear about what was going to happen. And then studying the patterns, I was thinking, well, if that's the case, why didn't the virus just roll right on from Milan down to Rome, down to Naples? Why didn't it just kind of roll that way? Why didn't the virus roll all the way through, you know, all over the country, kind of spread like a peanut butter all over the world? It didn't happen that way. The virus was moving from pockets of susceptibility. It was very interesting. The virus seemed to hunt, and it hunted for pockets of susceptibility. And if we look backwards, it's almost everywhere that there was a lockdown or people really hid in fear, the virus came hunting. And everywhere in the United States, everywhere where we had the most severe lockdowns, those states actually had the worst fit with the virus. And one of the things that you'd notice, Pete, in the world is that the responses to the pandemic couldn't be more disparate. They were so different. You had Sweden come out there and say, you know what, we're not shutting down. We're just going to treat this thing and life is going to move on. And there were pundits who said, oh boy, you just watch the Swedes. You know, I had just been to Sweden within the last year, and I was in Gothenburg, and it seemed like a pretty reasonable place and didn't seem much different than going to, you know, I don't know, Des Moines, Iowa, what have you. People, they weren't terribly socially distanced. They had a lot of punk rockers in the bar, people who look kind of gruffy like you do right now, and, you know, heavily tattooed young people who like to rock and roll. And, you know, I didn't see Sweden to be a special case of anything, but they had chosen a very, very different tact. We heard about other countries. We heard about Paris. We were communicating with friends in Paris. My wife has relatives there. They were saying, listen, we can't go outside to buy groceries unless we get an affidavit. This came pretty early on. What do you mean? You got to apply to go get groceries? So we couldn't see a more disparate or different response to this virus that seemed to be hunting all over the world. So what I did is I said, listen, I waited a week or two. I didn't see much going on. I heard all these institutions playing defense. And I said, listen, let's get on offense. And I started turning on to the news because our clinics were closed. So what did we do during the day? I worked on my research and I turned on the news. And I started to watch the news cycle, which became a very compressed and very narrow view of things. You know, in the United States, we have not seen a view of your country, Australia. We haven't seen you guys in a year. We haven't seen Moscow in a year. We haven't seen Johannesburg or Capetown or Paris. The world has become so small in the United States It's as if the rest of the world doesn't exist. It is amazing. And we never see a view of how the pandemic is influencing other places. Never, never. It's just absolutely collapsed on us. So I led the early treatment response in the United States. I published the first set of papers guiding doctors how to treat COVID-19. We communicated. We said, listen, this is a war. We're not going to wait for large randomized trials. I lead randomized trials. These things take 5 years. That's ridiculous to wait for large randomized trials. We're going to look for drugs that have a signal of benefit, acceptable safety, put them together in combinations, and we're going with it. Forget FDA approval. Forget your TGA. We don't need them. Doctors are going to do this, and we'll take care of the problem now, and we'll figure out things later on in terms of guidelines or anything else. Because we saw the guidelines. We had the Infectious Disease Society Guidelines of America. They went to 3 or 4 versions of the guidelines, never addressing the outpatient. It was always about the inpatients. National Institutes of Health, always about the inpatient. World Health Organization, all about the inpatient. The only thing that was offered to people in their homes was wear a mask, stay in lockdown, stay in fear, hand sanitizer, and wait for the vaccine. There never was a mention ever about what you could do to treat COVID-19 at home. And that became to me a very disturbing sign, because this was the only illness where there would be almost never a mention of what to do at home. And then it got to the point where it was forbidden to say what could be done at home. And that started to become very alarming.
Yeah, I found that the first 3 to 4 months of when COVID became known around the world, I have been a chef for many years, and part of what we've shared with the world has been books, cookbooks, that have helped people improve their health, you know, build a strong, healthy, robust immune system, remove foods that can cause inflammation in the body, celebrate the foods that have great nutritional profiles, you know, whether it be organic fruits and vegetables, grass-fed organic meats and wild seafood that haven't been contaminated by human engineering, and eat nose to tail, make some broth. So we're basically eating like our grandparents would have eaten, or our ancestors, you know, non-contaminated food. And that seems to have worked for a lot of people that we've shared this information with. And I was waiting for the health experts that were on the television and the politicians to start talking about the things that we could do to stay healthy during this period of time. Adequate sunlight, clean water, fresh air, and beautiful food. And I interviewed a lot of doctors over this early period from around the world, and they were saying, you know, you want to make sure you have some zinc, you want to have some selenium in your food, you want to have some vitamin A, some vitamin K2, vitamin C, all of these things. And all I heard was crickets. It's like, surely these doctors and health experts could put out a little bit of information about how to eat healthy, because we understand that the comorbidities seem to be attacking, the virus seems to be attacking the people with comorbidities, type 2 diabetes, chronic inflammation, and the list goes on. It's like, and that was the first surprising thing, or one of the most surprising things about me. And still a year and a half later, we still haven't heard of anything. I think, again, I'll bring up Donald Trump, but Donald Trump talked about sunlight being good for you and vitamin C. So tell us about your protocol and what you and your other doctors started to prescribe, if I'm allowed to ask that, and where from that point then to where we are now, what has changed and what have you learned about this virus and the prescriptive nature of what you share with your colleagues and your patients?
Well, your series of comments bring up the entire concept in medicine called risk stratification. And it took us probably a month or two to realize that the virus does not kill people at random. It doesn't. We didn't have the same random number of children die as the same random number of people in their 80s die. the virus very clearly, its infection was amenable to risk stratification and with actually great precision. And so papers started to be published, and what seemed to be okay in the medical literature was anything describing the virus was okay. Anything regarding the biology of the virus is okay. The one thing that became off limits in the medical literature was how to treat the virus. And if we had anything that didn't seem to be along some preordained path, for instance, vaccination or a drug like remdesivir, for instance, anything outside of that quickly became out of bounds. The editors were not going to let anything go through with respect to nutraceuticals or orally available drugs. But risk stratification is very important. And conceptually, what we learned is age less than 50, no medical problems, the chances of ever being hospitalized or dying with the virus is less than 1%. We could almost bank on that, except if the presentation in a young person is with severe symptoms. And we learned there was a paper that came out of Lagos, Nigeria. I'll never forget because I was the reviewer. And the Nigerians described young people, if in the first couple of days, they really developed shortness of breath and difficulty breathing, they developed an early fulminant course that was not going to be survivable without treatment. Otherwise, if it started out with some nasal congestion, loss of taste, fever, just the usual mild symptoms, we could identify an individual to just ride it out. So what we arrived at in our first paper was that risk stratification. So age less than 50, no medical problems, present with severe symptoms, just ride it out. The nutraceutical bundle was helpful and it was supportive data because deficiencies in those entities you mentioned were related to risk. And in fact, supplementation looked like from some of the studies could make a difference. And so zinc, 50 milligrams of elemental zinc a day, vitamin D3, 5,000 international units, vitamin C, 3,000 milligrams, quercetin or quercetin, a polyphenol substance, 500 milligrams twice a day. One could add N-acetylcysteine, lysine. You mentioned vitamin K2. This idea of getting, from a vitamin perspective, fortified was very, very solid. The other thing that became clear is that general health really did matter. And I looked at my own health over the last year, and I understood that I was taking some risks, just like Vladimir Zelenko was, and these other hero doctors, Ben Marble, Al Johnson here in Dallas, Brian Tyson, George Fareed. We started realizing as we communicate each other, listen, we're taking risks. We're treating an illness that all of our big medical centers are basically hiding in fear from. The big medical centers never even put a tent out in front. They didn't go even so much lift a finger to try to help patients with COVID-19. Now, if patients came in sick at the end of this outpatient period and had to be hospitalized, they took them. But every single medical center in the United States and elsewhere did not even try to help a patient. In fact, we learned from another very interesting character, Didier Rialt and Matthew Millon in Marseille, France, where they opened up a day hospital. They said, you know what, we can handle this. We're going to put up a tent and we're going to take care of people. And they started working with combinations of drugs to actually show that they could make a difference. And they also fronted this nutraceutical bundle. So the protocol is age less than 50, nutraceutical bundle, ride it out at home, quarantine at home. And in fact, once the fever is resolved and the symptoms have resolved, one can actually have a dry cough and return to work. And my hospital and health system quickly learned not to do any testing to come back to work. And I'll never forget when I had the virus myself, I called employee health and I said, well, what do I do? Do I need a test to come back to work? She goes, are you kidding? These tests stay positive for months afterwards. We learned this, that if we kept testing the nurses, they'd never come back to work. And I said, oh, I didn't know that. So to this day, where I work at a major hospital, largest health system in Texas, we rely on a clinical diagnosis that is developing the signs and symptoms of COVID, some type of confirmatory test acutely. Mine was actually a nasal antigen test, and that, you know, that's fine. Nasal PCR test at a low cycle threshold, that's fine. And then outside of that, no testing. Clinical follow through. And then once the fever has resolved, I think it was 72 hours without a fever, mild symptoms, return back to work, because we know that the contagious period is relatively short. Now, age over 50 or with medical problems or presenting with severe symptoms, and we start adding the medical problems or the age, the risk gets higher. So let's take someone age 65 with heart and lung disease as an example, or prior cancer or obesity or diabetes. We could be looking at a 20% chance of hospitalization and death. That's a pretty big number. In cardiology, we consider less than 1% low, 1% to 5% moderate, and over 5% high, because you know we're a conservative specialty. We deal with the heart, and the heart's high risk. You know, over 5% for anything, Pete, hospitalization and death, that's high risk. And so after the nutraceutical bundle, we learned early that we could combine drugs. We could use the combined strength of hydroxychloroquine plus azithromycin or doxycycline or ivermectin plus one of those two drugs, or favipiravir in five countries. That's an oral drug that was used for influenza, but also has activity against COVID-19. And then within a few months, actually, towards November in the United States, we could up to monoclonal antibody preparations, one by Lilly and one by Regeneron. They were absolutely terrific. So we could actually handle that early viral replication phase when the virus was replicating, with the first few days at home when people feel well. Then the next stage was to handle inflammation. And this story is interesting because there was a maverick in West Texas, an ex-military doctor named Richard Bartlett. And we started seeing him on the news. He goes, I know how to treat this virus. We can give inhaled budesonide, which is kind of a strong inhaled steroid. It's called Pulmicort in the United States. And he said, it works. And people immediately charged him. This guy's a quack. He's a charlatan. And he was discredited. Well, sure enough, the British did a prospective randomized trial, which is our gold standard, of inhaled budesonide. It reduced the chances of going to the emergency room or being hospitalized by over 80%. So he was vindicated. He was on track. Corticosteroids, we learned in the hospital that they had a role in inhaled oral steroids. And so the most common one we use is prednisone, but dexamethasone or hydrocortisone be fine. They have a reduction in mortality. And then the Canadians did an important study with colchicine. Following the Greeks, Greeks did the Greco trial with oral colchicine. Canadians followed it up with a huge trial called Colcorona. Colchicine, a repurposed drug for gout, taken once a day for 30 days, dramatically reduced hospitalization and death. So we had that next box of inflammation pretty well handled, and we were happy with that. We were just down to blood clotting. What in the world do we do for blood clotting? What we learned over time, all from inpatient studies, is to use aspirin, 325 milligrams a day, adult aspirin, all the way through. And then in higher risk patients, do injections of low molecular weight heparin or novel oral anticoagulants. These would be prescriptions. So as long as we handle viral replication, the inflammation, and the thrombosis every time, if we did it early, what we learned, Vladimir Zelenko showed this, and then Brian Proctor in Dallas showed this, that we could reduce the risk of hospitalization and death by 85%. It was so interesting, Pete, because this story evolved. We had the two seminal papers showing the protocol, one in the American Journal of Medicine in August of 2020, the second one in Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine with the updated protocol in December of 2020. They became the two anchors, and things were off and running. Our agencies, though, in our U.S. FDA, the National Institutes of Health, and the Center for Disease Control, your TGA, the World Health Organization, they became completely oblivious to early outpatient treatment. To this day, I don't even know if they know what happened. But what happened in the United States is Senator Ron Johnson got so frustrated with this. He reached out to me, said, Dr. McCullough, it looks like you're kind of leading a revolution here. I want you to go tell America what you're doing. And we had a series of U.S. Senate hearings on November 19th was the first one. The second one was in December 7th. I kind of helped him line up the doctors for the December 7th hearings, or the 8th, I'm sorry. And it was revolutionary. We basically told America, listen, we can handle this. We can treat it. And it kind of doesn't matter if our government agencies care or don't care, or if they're oblivious or not oblivious. It doesn't matter. We're doing this. And that was my testimony. I was recovering from COVID at the time. And that U.S. Senate testimony, I looked like hell on the tape. And I never forget, the mask was hanging off one ear. And I held up my protocol and I said, listen, I'm not asking for permission to do this. I'm asking for your help, because if we don't do something, we're going to get buried with all these cases of COVID. And in fact, early treatment kicked in big time after those hearings. The hero of the second set of hearings is also a kind of now a legendary doctor in the United States, Pierre Corey. He's a big hulk of a man. He showed up. He wore his white lab coat right into the U.S. Senate floor. And he said, the ivermectin is a miracle drug and we should use it. And he was very forceful. And we had J.J. Rochester from Florida. He had published a beautiful study in CHEST. All of these doctors who presented at the two sets of U.S. Senate hearings, in a sense, became American heroes. And we were actually proven to be American heroes as we were censored in YouTube and Twitter and social media. We were being knocked out right and left. And every time somebody got knocked out, it became literally a badge of honor. So listen, everyone, follow him. He got knocked out. He must have the right idea. And quickly, Americans started to learn, wait a minute, these doctors who actually learned how to treat the problem, they're being knocked out through censorship. And what happened in the United States is that we had a huge kick of early treatment. We crushed the epidemic curve towards the end of December and January. And before anybody was fully vaccinated, we basically had handled the problem. And when I testified in the Texas Senate that you mentioned on March 10th of 2020, I told Texas, which was a state that never locked down, we're a big population, we are a big early treatment state. We ended up 24th, I think, in terms of deaths and hospitalizations in the United States. I told Texas in March 10th, I said, listen, we're at herd immunity. We're at 80% of people by the CDC equation that is herd immunity. It doesn't mean, you know, 20% of the state getting sick would be a disaster. Herd immunity doesn't mean it's over. It just means we cannot get another wave. That's what herd immunity means. One of the public health officials backed me up a few weeks later. And in fact, Governor Abbott said, listen, play ball. And the Texas Arlington baseball stadium opened. We had every seat full. And the Texas Rangers played their first game of baseball. And, you know, our public health officials were on top of that. They said, there's going to be an outbreak in Dallas, Texas, with all these people next to each other without any masks. And you know what, Pete? Nothing happened. So Dr. McCullough was right on herd immunity. And one of the things I've learned, if I've learned anything through this, is to trust my judgment. I started getting so frustrated with this, I published a series of opinion editorials in The Hill, a political journal, that's actually not necessarily aligned with my political views, but they took my opinions. And I published, I think, about 12 of them. I nailed every single twist and turn of the pandemic, every single one, including early treatment, vaccine development, what was going to happen there, the fact that we are going to close out the pandemic with early treatment. And so this is really a story of now American success and ingenuity and independence. There's been a couple of the news stations that have picked this up, I think easily since November, Fox News, Laura Ingraham, Ingraham Engel. I've been on probably now a dozen times. I was just on last night, for instance, and we are hailed as heroes with respect to early treatment. Tucker Carlson has brought it on our show. Tonight, I'm going to be on Dan Ball, Real America. I'll be on Sebastian Gorka on Sunday night. Senator Ron Johnson is on Maria Bartiromo tomorrow on CNBC. I mean, we're the early treatment doctors who went against the grain. Not a single one of us can, you know, give credit to Harvard Medical School or Mayo or Monash or Duke University or any other big name institutions. It was the little people, the heroes, that brought early treatment and crushed the curve. And now our team is big. Eric Grimaldi in Italy, treatment domiciliary. He just had a rally in one of the piazzas in Italy, and he had thousands of people. And Eric Grimaldi declared zero hospitalizations with the Italian early treatment approach using multiple drugs. In the UK, they just had a rally, people holding up signs demanding ivermectin and treatment. Since when does the public demand simple, cheap, generic drugs? So it's been quite a story.
What an amazing story. What I'm struggling to understand here, as a layperson just observing this, is you mentioned the FDA and the CDC, and it's not like you're, I don't want to use the word quack or an alternative doctor or somebody on the fringe, so to speak. You are a highly qualified, highly respected, traditional doctor. And the treatment that you're using is pharmaceutical based. And, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there and cynics out there in the world. And I think it's over the last year, it's brought out a lot of questions and a lot of curiosity and a lot of skepticism and a lot of what the hell is going on here, because it doesn't make a lot of sense. So why when you're promoting pharmaceuticals as your tool to help people, why wasn't this celebrated or acknowledged or supported by the FDA, which is the forefront of the pharmaceutical industry, I believe, and the regulatory body? Why are they not? Why was there reluctance in that supporting of what you and your colleagues were doing by promoting pharmaceuticals? And I'll just put it this, for anybody that's listening, I'm a huge fan of modern medicine and also ancient wisdom, as I talked about before, or natural therapies. I don't think we should look at one without the other. I think holistic means looking at all of these. So I'd like for you to answer that question.
It was almost as if a fog or a trance set into almost every mind in America, that there was just literally a trance. And you could see as if almost everybody was in a dream, and then they would come out of the dream and say a little something, but couldn't get things on track. So let me give you an example. I told you, it was clear to me in March that there are only two bad outcomes, hospitalization and death, and that we should organize to prevent hospitalization and death. Do you know, to this day, there isn't a single leader at any level in any country, and there's nobody in any regulatory body that's actually ever said that. They've never said hospitalization and death are bad outcomes and we can prevent them and we should prevent them. No one's actually framed the problem. If you look at the guidelines, there are guidelines. TGA has a guideline like a document. So does the NIH, the Infectious Disease Society of America. You look at everything the World Health Organization has done. Not a single one of them has said treat to prevent hospitalization and death. None. It is so enigmatic that there could be like a brain fog where the human mind could not articulate the goal. The goal. So we've been through President Trump. We've had the White House Task Force. We've had all the leaders of the agencies. They've actually never been able to articulate the goal. It's stunning. You've had no one in Australia, probably outside of Craig Kelly and a few heroes, that can actually articulate the goal. They are, it is a lapse of mental function. If you can't articulate the goal, then they can't possibly comprehend what we're trying to do to prevent these bad outcomes. Instead, I think fear set in over the human mind and people started scrambling. No, the goal is to prevent the spread of disease. So let's wear masks and stay in lockdown. Wait a minute, that's a different goal. Preventing the spread of disease applies to well people. It doesn't apply to sick people. And what I said in the Texas Senate is focus on sick people. Far less than 1% of people get this illness. If we focus on the 99%, we're going to forget the 1% who really need us. Focus on the 1%. And if we treat the 1%, we reduce the spread of illness because we shorten the duration that the virus is replicating. We reduce hospitalization and death. Every hospitalization spreads the virus everywhere. So the goal of early treatment was the triple crown: reduce the spread of illness, reduce hospitalization and death. But no one outside of myself and probably fewer than 1,000 people in the world could actually articulate clearly what the goal was. And they are in a complete fog. To this day, they're in a fog. When you see them on TV, they're talking about masks or they're talking about vaccines, but they cannot focus on the goal.
So where are we now? We're in June 2021. Tell us about yourself and other doctors in the United States. Is it different state by state? Is there a protocol now that is the gold standard, so to speak, or are you still on the outskirts of what is considered normal.
Well, what happened was the like-minded doctors, and there was a small number of them, initially one organization, the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, we created a directory of treating doctors. We created a patient guide in October, a PDF, and we said, listen, download it and follow it. It included suggestions on nutraceuticals, the risk stratification, and then seeking treatment. And we told patients, listen, if your doctors will do this for you, fine. If not, contact a telemedicine service. And we started organizing telemedicine services. And now we have 4 national telemedicine services. We got 15 regional services. If we have, let's say, 20,000 patients getting COVID-19 per day in the United States, we're handling a third of those who are having severe symptoms, 5,000 through telemedicine. I think the telemedicine services at one point in time could handle about 15,000 people a day. And they call in prescriptions to pharmacies. If the pharmacies try to block the medications, we use mail order pharmacies and get, see that the illness progresses slowly. So we actually have time to get drugs to patients. And we basically took over healthcare in the United States without the agencies really knowing. So it's the oddest thing. So patients who get sick, they typically go to an urgent care center or an ER. They get the diagnosis of COVID-19. Those two places tell them, go home, there's no treatment. And then the patients say, okay, they go home and they go, I know there's treatment because I'm on the internet and I'm listening. I'm listening to Dr. McCullough. Let me contact a telemedicine service and I'll get the drug shipped to me. And they do that every day. So it's the most interesting thing that patients have figured it out. We've crushed the curves. The same thing has happened across so many different countries. Now, other countries have done it publicly. You know, Mexico City was getting absolutely slammed. And I had colleagues down there. We were talking. They said, listen, we got 1,200 patients in the hospital with COVID, huge numbers of people on the ventilator. They finally got their act together, swept in, had ivermectin-based protocols. They crushed the curve. We watched several South American countries crush the curve. The Italians finally kicked in. They got some confusion on hydroxychloroquine. They finally got on track. They crushed the curve and have things under control. Other countries never had a problem. Moscow always had early treatment. They had favipiravir. They brought things in right away. You saw countries, densely populated countries, had things under control. Bangladesh, Pakistan, they really had it together. Iran had a hydroxychloroquine-based approach. So any of the countries that embraced early treatment figured it out. Now, it's frustrating because these drugs became political footballs. Hydroxychloroquine became one of them, where the countries correctly stockpiled the drugs, and then it became a political football. Ivermectin became the next political football. I mentioned AAPS in the United States, another group formed called Frontline Critical Care Consortium, FLCC. Then we had Panda form in South Africa. We had Heart and Bird form in the UK, Treatment Domiciliary in Italy, COVID Medical Network in Australia. And we started communicating. We said, listen, if our government leaders can't articulate the problem, they're certainly not going to get close to finding a solution. And we quickly gave up on our government agencies. Our preference would be for them just to get out of the way and not try to block what we're doing. Now, the blocking of what we're doing became a real problem and still is a problem, for instance, in Australia. The government agencies, if they are just, you know, gripped in fear or they're just seized with ineptitude, in my view, they should just get out of the way and let real doctors take care of the problem.
You mentioned something before about blood clotting, and we're seeing a little bit of that in the media at the moment about vaccines. Why is this a, and I don't know whether this is your, whether you can answer this, and I understand if you can't, but why does that seem to be a side effect for some of these vaccines? I think it's the AstraZeneca for memory that seems to be having these blood clotting issues, because you mentioned the blood clotting is part of the virus for some people, and it was sort of how do we deal with this? So what is that?
Well, we should get into vaccines for a moment and have everybody understand the major ways we give vaccines. We have 70 of them on the U.S. market. I've taken them all. 98% of Americans take all the vaccines. So it's, you know, we don't have any problem with vaccines. They're normally either a dead virus or they're in a weakened virus that the body responds to. And we know the weakened virus can't cause any damage. And we know the dead virus can't cause any damage. Or we just give a dead piece of protein, like tetanus, and we just have the body respond to it. So vaccines themselves never introduce something active into the body that can cause damage. Never. What we learned is really disturbing, Pete. This is the disturbing part of the story. The virus, SARS-CoV-2, or the COVID-19 illness, appears to be an attempt at creating a bioterrorism weapon out of the lab in Wuhan, China. And there was gain-of-function research to make the spike, the spine on the ball of the virus, more dangerous and more infectious. And that gain-of-function research gave that spike protein the ability to cause blood clotting, and had the spike protein be able to connect the red blood cells and platelets and promote clotting. So for the first time, we had a virus that was more infectious, but in a sense was designed to kill because of its ability to promote blood clotting. Now, the vaccines all have, in a sense, kind of a dangerous concept. They contain the code, the genetic code for the spike protein, and only the spike protein alone, not the whole virus. And so the code of the spike protein is coded for the original Wuhan spike, not any mutant forms, but the original Wuhan form. And so it the virus, the vaccines, all of them, the messenger RNA vaccines and the adenoviral vaccines, all trick the body into producing the spike protein. And we've only learned this recently, that the spike protein is produced in an uncontrollable manner in the body after vaccination for about 2 weeks. So this is the first time in human history where we're giving the vaccine and then the body itself is making a dangerous, in a sense, product of bioterrorism and letting it circulate uncontrollably in the human body for 2 weeks. Even the natural infection doesn't do that. You know, the natural infection, you breathe it in, it's in your nose, you start to fight it off. But we don't have 2 weeks of spike protein circulating the body, potentially damaging the body. Now, the hope with the vaccines is you just get a little spin of the spike protein, you'd form an immune reaction to it, and you'd get out of it fine. But then the experiment of the vaccines, the dangerous part of the vaccine is, you know, are there some people that they don't shut off production of the spike protein? Or maybe they produce too much of it. Or maybe their body is susceptible to spike protein damage and blood clotting. And we've learned, you know, we've got a great experience with Pfizer and Moderna in the United States.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.